You're listening to the What's the Fuzz podcast, where we break you out of your vacuum seal and get down to what's real. Never miss another episode again. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And now, your host, Reiner.
Hey, Fuzzos, what is up? Glad to see you again for this week of What's the Fuzz. And if it's your first time listening, nice to meet you. I'm Reiner, a big blue dragon boy. This episode was recorded back in February and should be released around March 16th, 2021. We'll be talking about Canadian immigration, East Asia, and ambiguous identity in this episode of What's the Fuzz.
So I'm sitting down with Kavrick, a unique addition to the furry fandom with art that draws the eye from every angle. Be sure to check them out over on Twitter, at Kavrick, and I'll be linking their other projects in the show notes below. Thanks so much for coming on the show tonight, Kavrick. You may just be the first guest living in Canada that I get to talk to, and I'm super looking forward to your perspective on a few things.
Am I the first one living in Canada?
I think so, yeah. We've had people from London, we've had people from Singapore now, and mostly it's been based in America, so I think you might be the first person that's at least immigrated from a different country to Canada, at least.
Okay. First immigrant.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that's all interesting.
Right. But first, I'd like to throw out an icebreaker question.
Yeah.
What is the strangest request you've ever gotten to draw something?
Strangest requests? How safe for work are we? Are we talking on the show?
Oh, this show, you can say whatever you want.
Strangest commission. It's more a commission than a request.
Because
I don't usually get requests, actually. I don't usually get, like, creepy people in my DMs or, like, unsolicited things like that. I can talk about that later. But I think just, if you just want, like, the weirdest commission I guess I've ever gotten is someone just wanted their, their pinata sona in a lewd calm with someone else's pinata sona. I'm like, all right.
Okay. That didn't go as far as I thought it was going to be. No, I was thinking they wanted
tame,
to beat the candy out of them, and that was like their kink.
Not really. It was just I ended up just drawing them doggy styling. So,
okay, that's pretty tame by their standards.
Yeah,
right?
It is pretty. I mean, it's pretty tame in the community at large. But I also that is like I think one of the only times might have been the only time I've actually like done a not safe for work commission.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised. I thought you were like strictly safe work kind of thing.
Yeah, I can think of two instances, and that was one of them. Usually when I do draw NSFW, it's usually just for friends. Because anatomy sucks, and so I realized recently that a lot of my artistic drive comes out of the results rather than the process. And so drawing friends is one way for me to stay motivated throughout the entire process, so that I don't like end up stagnating, which is part of a reason why I have trouble with commissions and also why I don't do NSFW, because that's not really something I'm confident enough to start charging people money for, I guess.
Gotcha. And now you know what happens when you watch too much of Viva Pinata when you're a kid out there. Listeners, be careful, watch wisely. So now we can get into the real questions over here. First, I think our listeners would like to know a little bit more about your background.
Background.
We would like to get to know about you, like how old you are, where you're from, your pronouns, your ethnicity, and how you would describe your sexuality / gender identity if you feel so comfortable with that.
I got the basics out of the way. My name is Kavrick, as you know. You can call me Cav. I am turning 23 in a couple of weeks. And my pronouns, I think most people use he, him. I personally don't really mind, but there you go. I guess if you want to ask me what my gender is, I'd answer male. I was born in Hong Kong in 1998, because I'm 23. As you know, there's maths involved here. I'm very
Quick
sorry.
Maths.
Yeah, and more math than coming. I'm half Japanese and half Hong Kong Chinese. My mom's Chinese. She was born and grew up in Hong Kong. My dad was born in Japan, and after a huge like tour of the world during his formative years, he ended up in Hong Kong, and that's how I met my mom. And I was born there. I grew up there. I went to a Canadian international school. So in Hong Kong, you usually have schools. You might have school. Yeah, there's a public school system, but there are also schools that we call them international schools because they have curriculums from other countries. So I was, even though I was living in Hong Kong, I had not been to Canada until I was in, I think, secondary school for like a summer holiday. I was taught under the Canadian curriculum, despite never having gone to Canada. And so I grew up there, went to school there. And then eventually I came to Canada in 2018 to start studying. And that's what I'm still doing right now. In terms of sexuality, I guess I'm gray ace / pan.
I guess it's kind of weird to talk about. So
I hope everyone's taking notes at home, by the way, because there's going to be an exam at the end of this. but yeah, that's just the gist of my background. Half Japanese, half Hong Kong Chinese, born in Hong Kong, grew up in Hong Kong, raised in Hong Kong, go to school, went to school in Hong Kong, but now going to secondary school in Canada.
Whew, what a trip.
It's a bit of a trip, yeah.
All right. So who's your main persona and what is your main persona and how do you feel you express yourself through them?
This can get real really quickly.
feel free.
My main persona is just, you know, it's Caverick, right? Well, I know, very imaginative name. I call them in universe. I have a little world building project that's a science fiction thing. They're a synthetic half, well, they call them half ants, so like they're half androids, so they basically just means they have two arms, two legs, and a head on top of a torso. Mm-hmm. But so they're basically a robot Sona. And I think this, what my whole thing with the Sona is actually something that's linked to how I feel about my identity in real life, if you can put it like that. It's,
of course, right,
like you already heard the my whole thing about my entire background. It's a freaking patchwork, right? There's just, and I think that's something that's kind of always stuck with me growing up. It's that I'm always finding myself in these kinds of weird middle grounds that aren't inherently very interesting on its own. For instance, you know, I grew up in Hong Kong, but since I went to the Canadian school, I was never really fluent in the local language, which was Cantonese in Hong Kong. It's just a dialect of, one of the Chinese languages. And so, okay, you're unique in that you're monolingual, speaking only English, but it's not really a uniqueness that's really cool, I guess. It's not very useful. It's not an attractive kind of unique. So, you know, growing up, you get taught, oh, it's good to be weird. It's great to be like unique and weird, and you know, and there's a certain degree of truth in that. But they don't, you know, growing up, it's kind of, it's good to be unique, and then you go ahead and be unique, and they go, hold on, not like that. I don't like that kind of unique. That's not the good kind of unique. How are we supposed to sell to you? And so I sort of grew, so that's just like part of it. And then the other part is being half Chinese, half Japanese. Chinese and Japanese, at least the governments, they don't really like each other. The simple geopolitics of that is that they don't, frankly, no country really likes Japan at this point because of what happened in a little thing called World War II, which is understandable. But I'm part of two different cultures that largely do not like each other. And I'm also living in Hong Kong, which is itself a kind of city stroke, not really country place that's also stuck in between. Is a part of China? I guess it is, but in effect it isn't. But more recently it kind of starting, it's kind of is, but it starts to get very messy. And for me, that's something that's I've seen repeated throughout my life, where you have this very, you have this sort of very complicated, not very clean identity that it's non-conformal in a way that is not very attractive, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find that I want to express that in myself. For my first many years in being a furry, actually online, there wasn't really a point where I like found I was a furry. It was just sort of a thing that dawned on me over time. There wasn't like a day that I realized, oh shit, I'm a furry, and like, I officially became one. It just sort of was a gradual process for me. But in my time in the community, my sona was just me. It's just like the human me. A little bit shorter for comedic effect, but he was just me. And the point of that was to basically create it was just having a bit of dark humor regarding my own identity, and that, okay, what's the most unique sona I could make in the fandom while simultaneously not being very interesting? That would be a human sona, wouldn't it?
Mm.
And so I did that for a little while, and the thing is, well, it worked really well because no one was very interested in it. And so it ended up working really too well. And so now, I think last year, I adopted this new sort of path and sona, which itself is kind of now this... Now there's another layer. You get ready for this. Now you have another layer where you have this sona that is kind of a more acceptable version of myself. So here I am compromising again, being kind of in this middle ground again. And then I poke fun at this again by insisting on my ref sheet that my species is human. And so it's about... the way I express myself with this sona is being kind of in the middle, in this space of ambiguity. Is he organic, or is he just like, is he actually like fully built? Where did he come from? Does he have to eat us? Does he recharge, or like what does he do? And like, that's kind of the point. It's that, okay, you have this impression, but that's kind of not really a true impression, which I think is a reflection of myself in some sense.
Interesting. So he's kind of like the embodiment of feeling out of place.
Always,
and having unique attributes, but not actually that interesting when you look into it. So like, you have a robot, but instead of doing something cool like shooting a laser beam, he just is pretty good at eating pizza.
Yeah, I'm good at eating pizza because my head is shaped exactly... Actually, no, that'd make it really bad, wouldn't it? Because... I'm going to have to rewrite that. Because my head's like triangle shaped, right? The jaw is triangle shaped, so maybe, but I don't really know. I don't think too much about this. Maybe, if there are any food experts, please comment below if there's a comment section. I don't know where this is going to be posted. But yeah, it's just this idea that it's unique, but kind of not really... Not, I don't want to say it's in the worst ways possible, but they're definitely not glamorous. It's like, okay, you're a robot, but you do have to eat. You're not superhumanly powerful. You're just a normal person who spends too much time in front of a computer, strong, stamina-wise. You certainly can't survive a cycle in the dishwasher like some people have joked.
Wow, okay. So you mentioned that coming into the fandom wasn't really like a snap decision or something. It's just kind of something that you just kind of get pulled into slowly over time.
Yeah, because it's the same. It's kind of odd because it's the same thing with my sexuality, right? You know, I think that's the better example. You know how people have that moment where they realize that, you know, oh, they're gay or trans or whatever, right? I didn't really have that day. rather, I didn't have one when I was younger. I did have one more recently where I did come out as Gray Ace, mm-hmm. I think a couple of years ago. But, you know, by that time I was already like 20, so it wasn't... I don't really see that personally as the same as coming out for other people. And I think the reason is that my parents kind of have this neutral, apathetic outlook in terms of social... At least my mom had a neutral, apathetic outlook towards social justice, because she was... She grew up in the 1970s and worked and entered the economy in like the 1980s in Hong Kong, which was sort of this big economic boom time where you had a lot of, you know, laissez-faire capitalism was now the new thing. So you had a lot of multinational corporations setting up shop in Hong Kong, and, you know, there was a lot of great work, but that was also the era of both parents working so that you could get a lot of money in the family.
Right.
And so my mom was a stockbroker for a fair amount of her career, and then like some kind of accountant at Bank of America. The point is that she had a very intense job. And so I imagine that kind of ended up factoring into her outlook, in that she wasn't homophobic. She's not homophobic. And she's not like transphobic or racist or anything. It's just she wouldn't join a march because I guess her outlook is that it's a complicated thing. Social justice is complicated. She already has enough complications in her life. And frankly, these young people seem to know the thing better than me. So I'm just going to leave it to them. It's not ideal, but what that basically meant was that I didn't really have a coming out day because I never felt like the need to.
That's understandable.
There was, yeah. So like my parents just don't really, my parents didn't really care, or they rather expressed that they didn't really care. And by extension, aside from, you know, the casual homophobia and sometimes racism you might get in school, where you just kind of like use some choice words, to put it mildly, no one was truly, in my opinion, no one was truly homophobic or truly racist. It was just because we're all busy anyway, and there were just better things we were worrying about. That wasn't ideal. I think having more support for sexuality would have been nice, but I'll take it, I guess. And that's why I don't really have a coming out day for my queerness, because there was never really a worry, I suppose. I'm very privileged to never have that worry of coming out and having people around me not accept it. I think by extension, that's kind of how the fandom, that's kind of how I ended up in furry as well. It's just, ever since I started drawing, I was already hanging out with a bunch of furries, who I met, grew up, because we all met because we played Minecraft. And, the new thing was, Minecarts at the time. Can you imagine that? And we all met during Minecraft, and that was also about the time I started drawing, and so I said, okay, I'll just draw some animal people as well. And I didn't really think much of it. My sister kind of teased me for it, but it wasn't major or anything. No one really does the same thing. No one really cared. And I didn't have a day when I became a furry. It was just, I just drew what I wanted to draw.
So it started out with drawing funny animals, basically. And then it just
I think already grade 4, primary 4, I think it was the same thing. I was already like drawing animal people, but I just didn't think much of it. It was just, you know, it was just animal people, right?
And it's just Zootopia fan fiction. I mean,
yeah, Zootopia wasn't a thing yet, obviously. It was,
yeah, I know.
It's like the Disney Robin Hood, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I suppose that's the takeaway of both my queerness and being a furry, is that I was never exposed to the negativity or like the societal pressures, I guess, or societal biases against like being queer or being a furry. So it was very benign to me for that reason. It was not a very big part of my identity, because it didn't have to be. No one really cared that I also liked boys and then men, right? No one really cared that I drew animal people, and therefore it was never really an issue. So there's your fun example for like how what systemic discrimination means, I guess.
Something like that.
It's not a problem. The problem isn't being queer. The problem is other people not treating you well because you're queer. So when you take that prejudice out of the equation, suddenly everything's hunky-dory.
How long would you say altogether you've been part of the fandom, like, from inception? About...
Gosh.
8 years?
Let me just think. I guess it would have been from... Maybe 9 years this year, I think.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, 2012, 2013 was when I started drawing. And I guess that was when I started drawing was also when I started, like, really drawing the animal peoples. And then also hanging out with other people who drew the animal people, so...
Do you often have to deal with misconceptions from furries in the fandom because you're, quote-unquote, Asian? Do they assume that you can't speak English well or that you have difficulties understanding things like, I don't know, a McDonald's Big Mac?
I mean, I think it's a mix because there's assumptions that go both ways, I think. So you have people who are like, wow, you speak really good English. And I'm like, all right, thanks. Thanks. That's the only language I know how to speak. So I better be good at it because there's not much else going for me if I can't. And stuff like that. And there's, you know, sometimes it's, you know, you speak really good English. It's like, so this is something we call spaghetti. I'm like, yes, I'm aware.
What the fuck?
I'm very aware. Okay. And there's, you know, there's also the typical flavor of, oh my god, you're from Hong Kong? That's like in Japan, isn't it? That's so cool. And it's just, you know, stuff like that. That sort of thing people have talked about. It's fine, that happens. The more interesting things is when it goes the other way. So people do think I'm a Canadian. I'm not. Legally, I have no... I'm a resident of Canada, but that's because I'm a student here. So I don't have any more grounding. I don't have any more legal status in Canada than any of my other students. I'm not Canadian. I speak good. I did go to a Canadian school. I do have an Ontario secondary school degree, but I'm not Canadian. I don't think I have the outlook of a Canadian. I don't think I learned how to use the dishwasher last week, for God's sake. This mm-hmm. week, no, it wasn't even that long ago. And the way it works the other way is that, you know, sometimes a couple of years ago, I went a little bit viral. I say a little bit viral, I mean, I got interviewed by the local television station.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And about this thread I made that was basically Canada Gothic. It is extremely long. It's not, personally, I don't think it's that interesting to read. It's a bit of a tome at this point, but apparently people liked it. So cool. And so much that I was interviewed. And, you know, a lot of it was just like the condensation of just stuff that's weird to you as an immigrant. But the reason I wrote that thread, part of the reason I wrote that thread was because as someone who passes as an Asian Canadian, as a Chinese Canadian, like someone who was born here, people don't really understand it when I point out that I find the amount of driving that one needs to do, for example, very strange. Like I point out, I don't understand what someone means when they say it's 30 minutes away. I kind of have an idea what that means now because I lived here, but prior then, you know, I was just like, that's not too far away. That's 30 minutes away. I don't know what that means. What's 30 minutes away? 30 light minutes? That's freaking enormous. I eventually learned that meant 30 minutes to drive, which I still don't know what that means because I don't drive anywhere. I take the train or the bus. And I point that out and say, isn't that kind of odd? Why can't you just use like normal units that measure distance rather than like time? And people are like, I don't, well, and people don't understand that. And they kind of give me shit for it because I think they expect me to, because I don't. I feel like if I spoke in a more broken English accent, for instance, then I would come off as more foreign and they'd be more understanding when I don't understand certain things about the local culture. But because I speak fluent English and therefore I do kind of pass off as Canadian, they're a bit less tolerant about that, if that makes sense.
On the bright side, if someone ever bothers you on the street, you can just pretend that you don't know English and they'll probably leave you alone.
Oh, right? Yeah, I do that. But it's kind of becoming a problem because of the COVID pandemic. So,
right.
So I can't do that anymore. So, because you get shit for it now. Especially if you look like you're foreign, then oh my god, you're gonna be in for a world of trouble, because you're not supposed to be traveling abroad, you heathen. You're supposed to be staying where you are. I mean, they tell me that anyway. But
so, what is it about being a part of BIPOC and part of the furry fandom that sets us apart from everybody else?
What do you mean sets us apart by anyone else?
Like, we deal with things like feeling excluded at fur cons and fur meets because we're the one person that's not white, the one person that doesn't have the same background as everybody else, etc.
Yeah, I think it does feel very exclusionary, because I think a lot of very popular furs. I've never said that word out loud, you know. The reason I hesitated was because I didn't really know how it was going to come out of my mouth when I said it. I think a lot of like sort of popular furries, or like furries who end up, you know, getting a lot of sets and panels and have a lot of influence over the fandom, they tend to be predominantly white, and it does feel a bit odd, to put it lightly, when you're kind of the only person who's not white in the room. I did write on Twitter about that, about how there's this sort of weird double standard when it comes to diversity in the fandom, because you have, on one hand, you have the fandom that basically loves everything that has to do with queerness, like the phrase gay furry is just kind of redundant, because being queer is sort of the de facto norm in the fandom. Mm-hmm. Like, you're kind of you're a furry. You're going to be queer in some way, unless otherwise stated, right? And you have that, and everyone loves flying the pride flags, whatever the flags may be. And there's, you know, a lot of very open discourse about queer discrimination at large, and, you know, trans rights and, you know, gay rights and intersex representation and things like that. And, you know, that's all great. This is good. I don't want to say that this is bad, because, you know, all that is very good. But you have all of that. You have this fandom that's very accepting and very eager to engage in topics about queerness and the diversity that comes with it. And then when it comes to race, it kind of becomes a hush-hush topic, and no one really wants to talk about it. It's like this. It's just like, okay, you want to talk about, I can advertise myself that I'm. You can advertise yourself as a narcissist, that you're queer, and you're queer or trans or gay or whatever. And that's, you know, it's good that you can do that in the fandom. There are not many places in the world that you can do that. But you can't do that when it comes to race, I think. I think there tends to be a certain air of discomfort when you start talking about race explicitly. I think the thing that white furries should understand is that social justice, or at least being an ally, isn't something you are or are not. It's not an inherent quality. It's a skill that you have to develop over time. it's going to be complicated. It's going to be like any skill. When you start off, when you're new to it, it's going to be uncomfortable because you're not going to be very good at it. And people will be able to point out that you're not very good at it. And so I think the fact that I was approached by one of the chairs of Fernal Equinox a little while ago about like different ways to make the con more POC friendly or progressive. And one of the things I ended up telling them, we kind of ended up tangenting over there as well, was that, you know, it's good that you're asking me for your advice, right? And it's good that you're asking me to like overlook things, but you know, you can change all the rules you want. You can make an exhaustive set of rules that covers every contingency about cultural appropriation and how to like not, how to identify whether it is or whether it isn't. You know, if this, like, what happens if we accidentally kick someone out for culturally appropriating, but they're actually part of that, you know, stuff like that, right? You can write a million rules in writing about that. But the thing is, it's our awareness about race and awareness about how to navigate the conversation about race is something you learn over time. It's not something that I can just sit you down, give you the briefing, and then you're automatic. Congratulations, you are now an ally. Let me hand you your ally certification for your 2-hour lecture crash course, right? I can't give you clear-cut answers about where to draw, for instance, I can't give you a clear cut answer about when something becomes when something changes from positive representation to negative cultural appropriation. I can't tell you the line because it's very fuzzy. And the only way you're ever going to be able to identify it is if you build up the experience to be able to feel confident in telling between the two things. Right. If I could sit you down and just give you a 1-hour lecture on exactly where the line is, and here's the 5 criteria on how to like judge whether something is culturally appropriative or not, and like just carry around this handy little cheat sheet, and you'll be able to tell, you know, stuff like that. Right? I would love it if I could do that, but you can't because it's a complicated topic, and with any complicated topics, you need to learn. It takes time, and I think. I think the fact that white people don't understand that it's this topic that takes time to learn, they think it's this thing that, if they think that it's this thing that you can one and shut learn in like an hour, it makes sense why they get extremely upset when POC call them out on something they didn't really know, and then tell them we can't really. You just have to listen to us, and we can't just sit you down and lecture you one-on-one, right? And I think that's why they get very upset at us, because we don't have all the answers because it's this complicated topic that you just have to get familiar with over time, and you have to listen to people who frankly know better than you and defer your opinion to them until you feel confident about going it alone. And I think that's why they get very uncomfortable. It's because they don't like the idea that they're being racist without, you know, the idea about being systemically racist is that it's not one individual. It's not necessarily that racism can happen even though no one's really being actively malicious. You can be passively racist because you have like certain imbued values that you were taught. And that's just, like, that's just your worldview, right? And it's not really your fault. But it is kind of something you have to be responsible for. And they don't like it when you point that out because when you call it out, they think, oh, you think I'm being a terrible person, right? You think I'm being a terrible individual, when you're attacking my character. And we're not really doing that. You were brought up as white, and you never learned this stuff. You're learning this for the first time. You're of course going to get it wrong, and it's not attack. It's not an attack on your person per se. It becomes a problem when you start actively resisting. It's like, I'm not racist. I don't use the N word. That's not That's not how that works. You have to listen. You have to listen to us. You have to actively listen to the experts who have lived with this all their life. And a lot of them don't like that, and that's why they get very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and then you put on top of it that not everyone that is basically not white is going to know everything about systemic racism or what part it plays in the world at large and all this stuff, because they're too busy working a shitty retail job to make ends meet, right?
Yeah.
Everybody is up to date on and educated about all this stuff, and not one person can represent that one group of people. One black person can't represent every black person. Yeah. Right.
And like, there's a lot of complicated intersections between, you know, race and class, for instance, or race and sexuality, or race or being trans, or that sort of thing.
Exactly.
And then, you know, I'm Asian, but I don't, even though I am I am a person of color, I don't speak on behalf of black or indigenous people, and I kind of expect them not to speak on behalf of me, because we don't know, because as it turns out, we don't know everything, right?
Exactly. Like, I can't speak to what personally would offend me for cultural appropriation if it was, like, in regards to something having to do with, like, the Native community or something like that.
Yeah.
That's on them to figure out.
Yeah.
And I can only speak to what I know has been shown to be just general no's. Like,
yeah.
calling me the N-word, definitely, that's a no. Across the board, right? That's a known thing.
Yeah.
But calling me... If I was personally offended by calling me like Afro or something like that, that would be for me to tell you, right?
Yeah. Like, if you, it's not my position. Like, as an Asian person, it's not my decision as to whether saying the N-word is bad or not. It's down to black people to figure that out. And they told me it's not okay. So I'll say, okay, it's not okay. It's not my decision. There was a recent incident where this Japanese artist was, revealed to have like this very, very basically based their entire career off of Native American appropriation and caricature. And I think Wolf called them out on it. And, you know, it became this whole thing on Twitter, and a lot of people started to ask me, you know, as a Japanese person, what do you think about this? And like, I don't. Well, they're culturally appropriating Native American stuff. That's not really. I'm not really the person who decides whether that's okay or not, right? Because I'm not a Native American. They're appropriating Native American cultures. So it's by that logic, it should be down to the Native Americans to decide whether or not that's okay or not. That's not my decision to make,
right?
And that's
why I interview so many people from like the same kind of place, right? So I want to interview people from China or Vietnam, Japan, Africa, whatever, you know, wherever their descent is from, right?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't take like 500 different people to paint like a perspective. It takes like more than that. It takes so much, and there's so much out there already. Like, there's already interviews, there's books, there's movies, there's plays, there's all this stuff that paints the picture of what we're really dealing with when we say that we want to push for diversity in the fandom, and
yes,
outside the fandom, obviously. But we're working with what we have right now. What we can change immediately is the fandom, because we have people in charge of these events that are touchable. They're tangible.
Yes.
We can hold them accountable. We can't hold Facebook accountable, really.
It's very difficult to do it. It's something like, I think one of the things that I've sort of taken internalized is that, you know, some people, you know, when some people say, oh, the furry fandom is full of drama, or the furry phantom is so-and-so, has so-and-so characteristic, right? I never usually believe it, I guess, because I find that, I think that the problems that are inherent in the furry fandom are just problems that are inherent everywhere in the world. It's just that the fandom provides an easy way to frame it and compartmentalize it into a more consumable socially consumable manner into like exactly. into like a portion that you can kind of grasp and understand. Mm. And so it's very easy to like get an idea of like what the broad demographic in the fandom is. So if you say people are racist in the fandom, yes, and people are racist in the real world. There are queer people in the fandom. There are definitely queer people outside of the fandom. And it's just a microcosm that it's just like this boundary that we have that we can like work within as this individual space that we have more control that is more consumable in terms of its scale. And I think in that sense it's really good that it's just a microcosm because it'll teach us how to confront these problems when we move outside of the fandom. Holding a con chair accountable is just a smaller version of holding, you know, any a larger events chair or like a company leadership or government leadership accountable. It's exactly. that. It's just smaller scale, I think.
I don't think I could agree with you more. You're right on the head. The nail. The hammer, yes.
Nail and the is it the hammer on the? No, hold on.
I don't we'll mean the hammer and sickle. That's yeah, different.
It's okay. You can edit that out. It's fine. you say hammer and sickle too. I think there's also an intersection as it comes to race and just economic standing and just economic class as well. Mm. And I think that's also part of why we see this discrepancy. If you're Black or Native American or like a person of color in general, you're demographically you're just more likely to be less well off, yeah. And so if you're less well off, you're going to be working longer hours for lower paying jobs. You're going to have less free time to pursue things that you want to do. Mm-hmm. So if you're say a musician, for instance, in the fandom, and you don't have a lot of time to work on your musician, you're going to be beat out by someone who does have more time because they have more of a social safety net because they're basically better well off. They have a more stable job. They don't have to worry as much about working 9 to 5 or more likely 8 to 6 or whatever to make ends meet. They can devote more of their energy to being in the fandom, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And like, so they could go to events. They could
go to events. Music, they can they can produce music at a more prolific schedule. They can be far more influential, and then they eventually are the ones. And so, if you're more influential, you're more likely to be seen. I mean, you're more likely to be seen. You're more likely to be famous. You're more likely to be high profile. You're more likely to be featured in cons, to have panels, to be guests of honors, to have sets and things like that. And so there's an economic component to it as well, in that the more well off you are, the higher profile you are going to be in the fandom, and that's just kind of a given. I'm not gonna pretend I am from a very economically I'm from a privileged background, and so I think it's important to remind people of that, because people sometimes get really discouraged when they compare themselves to me and like the way I draw or how many followers I have or whatever. And, you know, I think it's worth reminding that I was lucky enough to have that opportunity to be able to not worry about making ends meet, and instead I can spend the afternoons drawing instead of finding how to get food on the table tonight, right? And so I think in that sense, it's not that certain people are working less hard, it's just that they just don't have the opportunity to devote their working hard into things that they want to do. I'm lucky that I can do that. I'm lucky that I can devote so much of my energy and time to drawing animal people on the internet. Other people are just less fortunate, and that's why they're less high profile than me. Are less high profile, and that's why certain people in the fandom are more high profile than others, because they just don't have as much time for this hobby, more or less.
That's true. That's true.
I think that's where you start to really hammer in about this whole race, this race thing in the fandom as well. It's not just that white people find it unfamiliar. It's that now you have this economic component whereby they might have to confront the reality that the reason they're famous is not necessarily because they're inherently better. It's just the fact that a lot of their success may also be attributable to the fact that they were privileged from the start. And that does something to your ego when you have to come to terms with the fact that a lot of your success was down to luck. It does kind of hurt me in some sense in a very minor way that, you know, a lot of the reason, you know, the only reason you're talking to me right now on this, you know, big show, right, is that I was more lucky than the next person to have the time to build an audience to the point where you would invite me to talk about this sort of thing.
Not inherently true. I did interview a few of my friends who have no followers, so...
Yeah. No, I mean it's that, but like also there's probably someone else who, you know, works just as hard on art as I do, who just has as insightful commentary about race as I do, but they just don't have as high a profile, and so they
and
don't...
And, you know, if someone like that is listening right now, I would love to talk to you. I want to give a mic to anybody out there that has something to say... but doesn't have anyone to listen. That's the whole reason that I do this show. I want to hear what you have to say.
That was a very good plug.
Right? Welcome to the middle of this episode. If you like what you're hearing, be sure to drop us a sub or a follow. If you happen to be listening on Spotify or some other platform, be sure to check out the show notes where we link useful resources as well as extended versions of these episodes on Patreon if they're available. Don't forget to follow us at whatsthefuzz_ on Twitter. And if you happen to be a BIPOC listener out there, don't be afraid to reach out to us to see how you can take part in the show yourself. Okay, that's all. On with the show. So you mentioned it briefly, but you are working on a science fiction world building kind of thing?
Yes.
So it's called Plus 700?
Plus 700, yes.
Okay. How did you get started with that?
I mean, this is kind of end up being cliche again. This is the exam that I mentioned at the beginning, in that there wasn't really a start to it, I guess. It started off as fan art for a musician. I just painted this spaceship, and it kind of escalated from there. It was mostly this. It started off as just like this fan art thing that kind of was taken a bit too seriously, I suppose. And then it ended up spiraling out into this, into its own thing. It began as this fan art thing, and then I turned it into this thing whereby, okay, I like the idea of having all the characters that I design and all of like my friends' characters to be on like the sort of, I guess, level playing field, a level backdrop that I can, if I'd want to draw them. And then that eventually evolved into this world-building project that reflects my own thoughts and beliefs and values and stuff, you know, as any world-building project does, as a way to explore certain ideas that I have. And I guess if you wanted to pin a start date for it, I guess the spaceship picture that I did was 2014. But the Plus 700 as I imagine it back then is like has basically no resemblance to the Plus 700 as it exists now.
Gotcha.
It was just, Plus 700 back then was just mostly a backdrop, so there was not a whole lot of thought put into exactly how the world worked or like what I wanted to explore with it. And so it was just this very, very middle of the road, very de facto kind of space setting, into like generic space, in interstellar space setting and it's got like the military, it's got the space military where everything has borrowed nautical terms and there are space space companies and space corporations and certain space cities and space like planets and like politics, and there's so many billion people living here and there, and like it was very generic in conception, I suppose.
What have you learned since you started doing it?
I think the most important thing that I've learned about world building is that, or not just world building, but just in general, is that you are not going to be able to make, it's impossible to make anything apolitical. I think another artist, a musician, Brian Eno, said that as well, and I'm gonna regurgitate that. And it is impossible to make something apolitical. For art especially, but not just art, but in this context, yes, especially for art. You think, you know, you do have a certain worldview, right? Everyone has one, because you live in a society and you think things about, you have opinions about things, right? That's a no-brainer, right? And with that comes a worldview about what you think is normal and what it isn't normal, what you think is acceptable and what you think is unacceptable or even dangerous, right? And so you can kind of look at, and so when I look at Plus 700 back as I was working on it in 2014, 2015, right? It was very much a reflection of my own worldview, even though I wasn't trying to make it, air quotes, political. It itself exuberated a certain idea about what was normal in my world. And what was normal was this idea of, a very linear, very linear technological progression, right? And that the advancement of a civilization was determined based on, you know, how superior its technology was, right? The idea that technology was the best factor to determine the air quotes advancements of a civilization, that capitalism was normal. That was just a natural state of human commerce and not a specific, highly constructed way of society as I now view it as. And I think that's something that a lot of other creators, especially other world builders, should probably keep in mind, is that whatever politics you have that you believe in is going to be reflected in what you create. If you have corporations in your space setting, either because you have actively decided that it proves your point, or because corporations to you, multinational or very large capitalist corporations, are very normal to you. And because they're very normal to you, you have put them into your world without thinking. And I think it's what I think what's important is to, not that that's bad or anything. I think, you know, we're all going to have inherent biases. And I think what's important is not to try to avoid them, but to try to embrace them and interrogate them.
I think
Plus 700 itself has gotten much, much better because I own the inherent politics that come imbued in that setting. I am a leftist, and so in the canon of the world, leftism is not only dominant, but it is a moral choice. I'm making a moral statement in my world, and I own that. The most moderate political faction in the setting is social democracy, which is not even really social democracy, is even more left than social democracy as we know it today. And I think just being more introspective about what you believe in, or what you think is normal, what you think is not normal, I think helps you better understand yourself.
How would you say your treatment has been as an immigrant in Canada?
Oh, that's a big topic, isn't it? I think it's been... I think it's been... If I'm honest, I think most people would expect me to reply to that. You know, there's some ups and downs, right? But I would say being an immigrant in another country is something that is kind of going to be... Like, in the end, like, net... Kind of a net negative experience. In terms of, like, identity. It's... There's obviously an inherent, like, positive to the fact that you are in this new country rather than your old one. And the reason you are in this new country is probably because your old one wasn't doing something very well for you. But I think in terms of, like, treatment, it's been very mixed, I guess. I think I mentioned previously, you know, you have a lot of people treating you like this weird exotic alien. And then you have a lot of people who kind of expect things from you, but you don't understand because you're from another country and another culture. Mm-hmm. And so they can't really, and they have a hard time comprehending the fact that people in other places of the world might think or do things differently. And if you reach that point, it's like banging your head against a cinder block wall. You're just never going to get through.
Because it's that thing where they think of, like, Asia or Asians as, like, a monolith, right?
Yeah, it's this very... I mean, it's that, and it's also this very, I guess, North America normative worldview as well. Like, everything that happens in Canada is normal, and that's just how it is normally all around the world, with some exceptions, rather than the fact that North America is its own place with its own... cultures, with an S, and own worldviews and own experiences and own norms that, like everywhere else in the world, that has, and, you know, it's things, you know, there's no normal, right? It's just, stuff's just different.
Right,
so
exactly.
I think people just have trouble grasping that, I suppose.
Like, people here will say that being paid a $7 minimum wage is normal. When some countries don't even have a minimum wage, but they have a very strong union. I wanted to know what exactly the distinction was between Hong Kong, China, and then China.
Mainland China?
Yeah, right.
All
right,
history lesson. So a little while ago, not so long ago, it's not still relevant, Britain had a big party all around the world, right?
Right.
And... As part of their party, they came in and said, you know, let's own Hong Kong. And after a couple of wars, they did. Now, what happened was that as part of one of these wars, there was a 99-year lease. So I guess Britain decided to rent Hong Kong rather than buying it from China or whatever.
Something like that.
And so this 99-year lease meant that Britain would retain Hong Kong as its own colony for 99 years after one of the Opium Wars, I believe. And after that lease expires, they will return it to China. That 99-year lease expired in 1997. And as part of that, and the thing is that a lot happens in 99 years, right? In those 99 years, just to name a couple of things, China underwent a bit of a cultural revolution, and so whereby its current one party, air quotes, communist state was like enforced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, meanwhile, Hong Kong didn't have that. It was still its own thing under British rule, and so it stayed mostly as a westernized capitalist democratic big asterisk city
thing, yeah,
city thing, city state, whatever. It's very strange, but it's its own thing. So now in 1997 comes around and we go, okay, well, this is a problem because China has this one party state, whereas Hong Kong has free speech and vote and democracy, I guess, and the free market. And this was 1997, so China wasn't exactly the big capitalist independent big conglomerate business thing that they are now just yet. And so part of it was China said, okay, as part of this 99, as part of getting Hong Kong back, we're going to do this thing called one party, two systems. No, sorry, not one. One country, two systems. And it goes like this. Hong Kong is technically, politically part of China. You would say, if you would write an ad, if you were to, you say Hong Kong is a China, is a city in China, let's say. Mm-hmm. However, functionally, the only thing that China has any say in Hong Kong, supposedly, is its standing military, so it has the PLA in Hong Kong, and foreign affairs. So you can't have a Hong Kong embassy, you have to go through the China embassy, as I understand. I might be wrong. And so those are supposedly the only two things. Everything else is independent and autonomous. Elections are autonomous. We're not legally bound to whatever Beijing wants us to do. Our laws can be different. Our justice system can be different from that of mainland China. Our market is, I think, technically distinct. And so on and so forth. It is functionally the countryest not country in the world, to put it one way.
So interesting.
Yeah. If you were to say Hong Kong is a part of China, you're technically not wrong, but it's kind of a, if you want to talk about like exact efficacy, at least up until a few years ago, if you want to talk about actual like efficacy, it doesn't really mean much because we effectively operate like Singapore does to Malaysia, where they're just two sovereign separate countries that just don't have anything to do with each other, more or less. Hong Kong is almost like that with mainland China.
Hmm. Hong Kong's like its whole own thing.
The local language is Cantonese, which is not the same as Mandarin Chinese or a lot of the dialects of or a lot of the Chinese languages that are spoken in the and it's got a lot of sharp consonants and like vowels, and it's just very easy to sound very angry when you're talking. It's like German in that regard.
True.
You just always sound angry. We have our own culture, and we have developed out of its own economy and its own political structure and its own beliefs. And so a lot of the Hong Kong cultural identity is made in context that Hong Kong Chinese people don't view themselves as the same as mainland Chinese people or mainland China in more broadly speaking. Which is why I say I'm ethnically Hong Kong Chinese, because some people do care about that distinction. Even though ethnically that I am Han Chinese, which is the majority Chinese ethnicity, the political divide is kind of significant enough for me to make that distinction.
Gotcha. Well, hey, thanks for the history lesson. I think I really understand that a lot more.
More complicated as it comes as you progress through what has happened in the last, I guess, half decade maybe.
Right, like because I knew that Britain like got that chunk of China, but I didn't know how that affected things necessarily, like how pervasive it was, but.
It's just that Hong Kong developed as a Western secular free market capitalist democracy.
It's kind of hard to like wrap your head around in a way.
Mm. It's just sort of, it's important to understand if you want to understand like what has been happening there for the past several years, and you know, why I'm even kind of here in the first place. So.
Okay, this interview has gone on for a very long time.
I'm very sorry.
It's all good. I think we learned a lot of important information, and you know, I'm always down for that. I'm always down to learn more about culture.
We didn't even talk about East Asian racism. That's interesting. How do you manage to avoid that one? It's the one that got away.
East Asian racism, huh?
Yeah, it's its own.
How do you mean?
Just the particulars as it comes to like how racial prejudice is held against Asians, and I guess because I say East Asians because that's what I'm most familiar with, and how how it manifests differently from racism against, say, black people or indigenous people.
Well, do tell. How does it manifest?
In North America, at least, I think there's this conception that Asian people don't experience racism, which is kind of laughable, especially in the last year of pandemic, where people just kind of assume that you're a walking virus incubator because you have almond eyes. But I think what I wish people would understand is that the racism levied against Asian people is there. It just doesn't manifest itself in the same way as racism against other races. East Asian ethnicity and East Asian history in North America is like a big factor, is the major factor into why it's different. Indigenous people were here first when the Europeans arrive and start acting like they own the place, right? Africans were taken as slaves and traded during the slave trade, more or less against their will. They were just taken, pushed out off of the boat and saying, this is your home now. Asian people didn't really have either of those. Asian people were more or less vetted, have a legacy of getting vetted by the white people who set up shop in North America. And so what happened was that in the early days of Canada and the United States, Chinese immigrants were usually taken on as low-wage labor. Most famously, there were the majority of labor used to build railways, including the Trans-Canada Railway, was Chinese labor. And it's the usual 9 yards of low pay and horrible working conditions and everything like that. So after they were done with the railway, North America, both America and Canada, began policies that would restrict immigration, particularly from China. And this would culminate in what is known in Canada as the Chinese Immigration Acts or the Chinese Exclusion Acts. At the height of those acts, the only way you as a Chinese person immigrating into Canada were to be let in was if you were a highly professional worker, I believe, so or a diplomat, a merchant. Actually, that's about it. Yeah, you had to be like incredibly skilled, and you also had to pay a flat fee of the equivalent of about $15,000 United States dollars up front. And so that separated a lot of families, but that also created a certain filter, so to speak, about what kinds of people who ended up in North America. Only highly educated, fairly wealthy Asian people who were, and more importantly, ones that would conform to white standards of success. And so that would end up, that right there would end up shaping the landscape of East Asian racialization in North America basically forever, I think. And so, like, the only way, if the only way was to get into Canada or in America for a good life was to become incredibly wealthy and incredibly Western educated, then that would change the culture back in China quite a bit about what makes a successful person. Suddenly, it makes sense why tiger moms are definitely a thing. It's because it's a large part of that is born out of the legacy of needing to raise your kids to be incredibly high achievers so that they would be let in into North America for a good life in the first place. It's also why you see, I think I had a friend of mine who also points out, you ever think it's weird how you have all these, you know, when you have these tiger moms and like these and the incredibly stringent expectations for Asians, the expectations tend to be very Western. So if you learn to play an instrument, you don't learn how to play like the suona or the arhu or like any, you don't learn how to play East Asian, Chinese or Japanese or anything instruments, right? You learn how to play the violin or the piano, very Western, very classical, aristocratic instrument, not the guitar even, just like the piano, violin, for symphony orchestra. You learn how to play Western games, Western sports. You learn English because that's a good thing. That's the entire, what has happened in effect is that white power, the white power structure has defined the entire success, the entire criteria for success for all Asians from India to the Middle East to China to Japan to Indonesia. And I think that is something that people don't tend to, even other POC don't realize. So when you see, the reason you see Asian people be fairly successful and fairly wealthy and well off in North America is because those were the only people who were allowed in. They were the only people who were allowed in, and subsequently the culture has ensured that I would be brought up to be like that. I was brought up learning 5 languages at the same time. I only ever stuck with one. I was learning French, I was learning Japanese, I was learning Cantonese and learning Mandarin Chinese, and on top of English, I only stuck with English. I was taking a sports class, I was taking piano classes. The Japanese thing was an extracurricular thing. I was taking also French tutoring on top of the French school stuff. And then I was also doing Kumon, which is like the maths thing, and eventually NOP, which is also a math like drill thing where you have to do a work booklet every single day of the week. On top of going to an IB certified school. So there is the legacy of this sort of expectation permeates throughout the world. In Asia is these high expectations. So I think when non-Asian POC look upon, or even like even white people look upon, you know, oh, these Asians are awfully smart, right? Think about why. It's not because we're smarter. We're not like inherently blessed. We don't work harder than other people. It is because we're expected to work harder than to meet these expectations of white people. It's been described to me as a sort of abusive relationship with white people. Asians have an abusive relationship with white people because they get to set the expectations for us. And if we don't conform to them, then that's too bad. We're the ones whose racial features they're allowed to joke about without feeling guilty about themselves. And if we call them out for that, then the abuse comes back and we're not allowed to participate in them. We're not allowed, they set our expectations. And through that, they also weaponize us against other POC, which I think is also very important for other POC to understand. They like to paint us as a model minority because, you know, we're all successful and all very wealthy and very smart. Why can't you black people or Native Americans or whomever be like those upstanding Asians? And when they say upstanding Asians, they say that because, not because we're like good or like whatever, but because it's specifically because we act in a way, aka white, that they like. We conform to their standards. They set the criteria for which we succeed on. And they weaponize that against other races. We don't. White people use that as a way to divide racial movements because you have a lot of Asian people who don't feel, who are told that they are not like the other POC and therefore you don't belong in the Black Lives Matter movement, for instance.
But when you stay, like when you stand out of line with that, you get stuff like the Japanese internment camps.
You get stuff like the Japanese internment camps. There's still xenophobia afoot, especially during the pandemic.
And it comes through. It's not even at random. It's something that's always there.
It's Beijing, always
Beijing, yeah. Biden, Kung Flu, China virus.
Orientalism in the cyberpunk genre is another one I think people don't realize. And it's everywhere. And this is what I mean by it's there. It just doesn't manifest itself as racism. The fact that it doesn't manifest itself in the same way as it does against Native American people and
it's black people, like, I think,
makes it difficult for other POC and white people to really parse how it works in this very, I'm going to say, sinister way.
Right, exactly. It's seen like, it's like white people see Asian people as like their good little dog. Like, it more can less, do tricks, yeah. Right?
Yes.
Because they kind of like, they think that the way that the kanji looks is like cool. So they put it on their bodies. It doesn't matter what it actually says, right? They have katanas. It's kind of like this weird false romanticism for something that is...
They get to... Unless we're made to let them make jokes about our racial identity. They get to co-opt things. And we're just supposed to let them without even having a discussion about where the lines might be. The assumption is that, it's fine because it's Asian culture and they're not oppressed. So, we're tea pal to your prom, I suppose. I think the other part to also understand is, how it's weaponized to as infighting with PLC, because admittedly, a lot of black Latinx, is that how you say it?
Latine.
And Native Americans and like others don't tend to view me as POC. And so I don't get to be part of a lot. So a lot of the time I don't get to be part of discussions about racial justice. I don't get to participate in discussions about cultural appropriation. Because they have been properly convinced that you should view Asian people as white people. And I think that's the most sinister part of it all. It's, they have managed to use us as a very effective method to divide and conquer. If they can make a whole, like, group of races, I won't even regard it as one, it's like a whole group, right? South Asia, East Asia, Pacific, as just kind of not viewed as POC by other POC, who knows what they can do.
Damn. That's horrific, dude.
I think it's getting better, especially in the fandom. I think more people are realizing that being Asian just means you are POC, and you do get a seat at the table, because these prejudices aren't over and they still need addressing. And that systemic racism can manifest itself in different ways, very sinister, very subtle ways that you might not realize it.
Absolutely.
And I think it's an important aspects, I think, for my POC, for my other POC non-Asian peers to understand, I think.
Yeah, exactly, because racism doesn't stop or start with Trump saying China virus, or Tucker Carlson calling Ilhan Omar a terrorist, or speakers at the RNC calling Mexicans dogs that will rape your wives and sisters.
Yeah.
It doesn't begin or end there. It begins with ignorance and it ends with exclusion, to the point there's no one left to exclude anymore.
Yeah. It ends with basically, I'll say it ends with genocide, more or less.
Yeah.
Cultural or otherwise.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a lot, it does, and it does affect us, because the legacy of needing to be a model of being expected to be a model minority on the behalf of white people who
who are the ones who get to judge this sort of thing means that I grew up with a lot of trauma. Because of all of that expectation piled onto my shoulders, I have been, you know, the academic pressures of needing to go to where it becomes so competitive to just get certain honor rolls or distinctions and do well in bell-curved exams and, like, how many math problems, even, like, being competitive for how many math problems you can solve in 60 seconds and, you know, oh, I'm at Kumon level F or whatever. And, you know, and I'm just one of them, you know, there's millions of people, millions of kids who are undergoing that sort of thing. And this is the kind of legacy that purports that comes from it. I've been, you know, even in my case, I have a fairly benign case, right? It's not like my family was poor, but, you know, you grow up with that kind of expectation. I've been sent to the ER because of depressive episodes, right? I won't get too into detail because it gets pretty gnarly. But, you know, it does. This is the legacy of systemic racism, and it's not as simple as, although it does include using racial slurs and a certain group of people being excluded or being segregated into a lower social class or lower economic class, it is not just that. It's so much more. Its mechanisms are so much more complicated than that. And this is why we need to talk and, like, you know, discuss these things openly, because you don't know what you're missing. You don't know is your idea of racism and what you're trying to, you know, is your idea of racism actually as all encompassing as you think it is? And if it isn't, then who are you leaving out in your attempt to for social justice? And is it really even a good attempt in social justice if you're leaving that many people?
Well said. All right. It is time for the last question of this interview.
It's been nearly 3 hours. Wow.
Yeah, it has. What is your favorite thing about being a furry?
My favorite thing about being a furry is that I don't look like a furry to a lot of people, and so I tell them that I'm a furry, and I like to watch the reactions.
I mean, that's one way to go about it. Sure,
because, like, you know, my whole, I think I say that kind of only half jokingly, because, you know, I have this. I told you about my identity being this ridiculous mishmash, hodgepodge of, like, crap, where I don't even know what to put in the field for nationality on, like, a form, right, that I'm filling out. And so let alone things like language, ethnicity, culture, upbringing, what I do as norms, what I don't. It's all a mess, right? I think one of the things that I'm not sure if it's inherent in the furry community, but I think it is, is my ability to recognize that, but also embrace that as something that's actually something I can work with, maybe not enjoy, but something I can, like, work with, right? And that's, I straddle the line between so many different places that, you know, this ambiguity is something I can actually enjoy about myself to a certain extent. I can enjoy the fact that I'm not, to some extent at least, when it's not bothersome anyway, that I'm not really part, I can't really answer any question about nationality because I don't feel like I'm part of any nationality. I can enjoy the fact that I have an art style that's not traditionally, air quotes, furry, but maybe that's a unique or good thing, or the fact that for many people, I don't even come off as furry at all. And I think it's a bit of this playful attitude towards this ambiguity that I think I would not have been able to find otherwise. But I think, you know, one thing that people are correct is that furries are pretty accepting. And if you put human on your ref sheet for your character that's clearly a robot, and people will accept that, right? People will say, "Yeah, okay, I'll call you what you want. I'll call you what you want to be called." I don't know what you are. I don't understand a single thing about you, but if you want me to call you that, I'll do that. And I think a lot of people, a lot of POC people, a lot of trans people, a lot of queer people, a lot of everyone can appreciate a community that will, that is willing to do that. And I think I can appreciate that too.
Alright, that just about does it for this episode. Thank you again for coming on the show, Cameron, and chatting with me.
Thank you for listening. That's a lot to go through.
It was my pleasure. That was one of the most fun discussions I've had on the show yet.
Yeah,
you've got the spotlight to promote anything you like. Go for it.
Oh, I didn't know there was going to be an exam. Oh my god. I've been fallen by my own sword. I don't know. I have an Etsy store and a Patreon, I guess. Yeah, just follow me on Twitter, I suppose. I do tweet a lot of political stuff, but I also sometimes make art. And I also try to signal boost other POC, other queer issues within the fandom. I try to provide my own commentary on certain things. So if that's your thing, then you can follow. If you don't, no hard feelings. You can also follow me on Weasel or Fur Affinity or ArtStation if you just want to see some of that science fiction, modernism, non-modernism stuff that I do.
Alright, be sure to follow the show at What's the Fuzz on Twitter and follow Kavrick at Kavrick. Thanks everybody out there for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.